Good morning. If you think it's been particularly meh over the last few weeks, well, you'd be right.
Well, the Met Erin people have a definition of a dull day. It's a day with less than half an hour of sunshine. The number of dull days have ranged from 10 days in a row at Malinhead and Donegal to 14 days, 2 weeks of dull days in Johnstown there in County Wexford. So,
and believe it or not, we're breaking records. Here's Alan O'Reilly from Carlo Weather.
Dublin Airport Station recorded another sunless day yesterday, which was the 10th day in a row, which is actually matches the second record of all time. So if today is indeed the 11th sunless day, which is likely at Dublin Airport, it'll match the all-time record for number of sunless days in Dublin at that station, which dates back to 1942, the record. So it is quite a long time without seeing some sunshine.
And what's going on? What's the reason for it?
Well, we have high pressure out to the northeast of us, and we had that easterly breeze that was bringing us that cool breeze last week, and it's also brought a lot of cloud in. So we're just really under some very moist air and some cloud. It's nothing too particularly unusual in terms of we do get cloud, but to have it for 11 days in a row, it is a bit unusual. Now, Casement in County Dublin had 0.4 hours of sunshine yesterday. So it does vary, obviously, and Belmullet actually had over 19 hours of sunshine in a week. So it does vary a lot across the island. But for those in the capital city, it's into the 11th day of no sunshine.
Stop your smiling, Colchies. The fight back begins.
Fabulous sunshine over Dublin Bay. That's John Kennedy on the seafront in Clontarf. Sun is shining in Castleknock in Dublin. Beautiful blue skies. That's blue skies over the data centre. It's still out. It's warm in Herbert Park. That's in South Dublin. The sun is shining for more than 30 minutes in the real capital. Thanks a million, Brendan. And it's shining in Galway as well, the sun. And elsewhere in the island, no doubt.
Mm-hmm. So there. But there will be some people who insist on tempting fate.
Let's take a little moment to welcome back that big yellow ball in the sky. Yes. After 11 days of consecutive greyness, the sun is back.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right.
It's very much all right. Thank you very much. I think we hexed it because we were gloating around the place there on the 1st of February saying it was the first day of spring. And indeed, we had some very spring-like weather with blue skies and the sun shining. And then the weather gods, as they do, said, don't be getting notions there about your fine weather and your blue skies and your sunshine. We'll show you what February can be like. And they did.
Shh, quiet. Do not anger them. But you might be glad of a bit of dull when you consider the veritable whirlwind that is the political world right now. Mic drop pronouncements almost every day. We speak of the talks between the US and Russia on the war in Ukraine. Officials from both countries met on Tuesday for 4.5 hours in Saudi Arabia with the aim of laying the groundwork to end the war, all in the absence of Ukraine or even European leaders. In Riyadh, Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, spoke to Rachel on the News at One just after those talks had finished.
What's known about what was discussed and what was agreed?
The talks wrapped up about 45 minutes ago, just before 3:30 local time here in Riyadh. And the initial readouts, both from the American and the Russian sides, some fairly tepid language. Yuri Ushakov, an advisor to Vladimir Putin, saying the talks weren't bad, but basically were only a first step. Similar language from America's State Department, which said that one meeting will fix the U.S.-Russia relationship, as they characterized it. So there were some promises of further talks. They're setting up what they call a consultation mechanism to talk about irritants in the U.S.-Russia relationship. But it doesn't seem as if there were too many concrete agreements that came out of these meetings today.
And on Tuesday evening, a press conference from his residence in Mar-a-Lago in Florida, where Donald Trump suggested that Ukraine were the aggressors in this war.
I have the power to end this war, and I think it's going very well. But today I heard, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
Message for Ukrainians who, after 3 years of fighting, might feel betrayed or disappointed at not having a seat at these initial talks in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think I'm really disappointed in what's happened. I've been watching this for 3 years. It's a war that would have never happened if I was president. And I've been watching these you know, people being killed at levels that you've rarely seen, not even close, since the Second World War. And I'm very disappointed. I hear that, you know, they're upset about not having a seat. Well, they've had a seat for 3 years and a long time before that. This could have been settled very easily. Just a half-baked negotiator could have settled this years ago.
President Trump also described Vladimir Zelensky as a dictator without elections, whose approval rating in Ukraine was at 4%. Now, Ukraine is currently under martial law, so elections cannot be held, and it is entirely unclear where that figure of 4% was sourced. And to all of the above, the Ukrainian president responded by saying that Trump was living in a disinformation space. Here at home on the News at One, Taoiseach Simon Harris was not mincing his words.
Well, look, I think anyone who attempts to blame Ukraine is clearly engaging in a revisionism on speed. I mean, the reality here is there's only been one aggressor in relation to this brutal, illegal invasion, and that is Vladimir Putin, who took a decision to invade a peaceful neighbouring country on the continent of Europe. And Ireland and the European Union, and indeed the United States, had stood in solidarity with Ukraine and with the people of Ukraine. I do think when it comes to rhetoric and commentary, though, I do think we need to be calm in our response, and we need to differentiate perhaps between comments that are made overnight and the reality on the ground. And the reality is everybody wants to see peace. Of course they do. But how peace is brought about matters. You cannot disregard the territorial independence or sovereignty of a country. You can't disregard the UN Charter. And you can't disregard the views of the European Union and European Union member states when this is indeed a war on the continent of Europe.
Nevertheless, European leaders are now grappling with this new normal in international relations. And one phrase we're hearing more and more is the deal. And when it comes to precious minerals in the ground in Ukraine, well, these are a resource open to trading. Misha Glenny, author and broadcaster, joined Claire.
Ukraine's natural resources, its mineral wealth now is on the table as a part of any potential deal. Will you give us an overview of what Ukraine has in that regard?
Yes, this came to the fore when Donald Trump the other day said that he wanted, in exchange for a peace deal, which would give Ukraine some of the things it wanted, although he didn't specify what those were. He wanted $500 billion worth of the mineral resources under the ground in Ukraine, saying that that would be payback for the money that America has already given Ukraine. Of course, America has only given Ukraine just over $100 billion, and so it's not a great deal as far as the Ukrainians are concerned, which is why Zelensky rejected it straight away. So Ukraine is a mineral superpower, potentially, with trillions of dollars worth of, there's coal and there's gas and there's a little bit of oil. But more importantly, there are rare earth minerals, which are this group of 17 elements, which are vital for any modern technologies, particularly computers, mobile phones, wind farms, solar panels, electric vehicles, and so on and so forth. So they've got the rare earth minerals, they've got lithium, they've got uranium, which is very important, of course, for the nuclear industry. And they have got titanium, which is important in the development, amongst other things, of jets. So this is potentially something really, really significant for Ukraine. But it has to be said that it's an underdeveloped industrial sector, and it would require billions of dollars of investment before you started getting these being produced on a mass scale. And of course, Russia wants these as well. And this is one of the reasons why Russia invaded in the first place.
Right. And events happening so very quickly, with European leaders seemingly on the back foot all week. But now, President Trump has invited France's Emmanuel Macron and the UK's Keir Starmer to a meeting in Washington next week. On yesterday's Morning Ireland, Gavin put this to Dr. Patrick Bury, Lecturer in Defence and Strategic Studies at Bath University.
If European leaders like Starmer and Macron are looking for reassurance from the United States that it has Europe's back, as it has had since 1945, is there any indication from Donald Trump since he took office that he will have Europe's back?
So there is, yeah. So if you listened very carefully to Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of State's speech at the NATO Defence Summit last week, he basically said that they want to make NATO great again. They value the alliance, but they are sick of taking the burden financially for that. And it's totally fair. And, you know, presidents all the way back to even, you know, JFK were talking about this. So, and Europe's been asleep at the wheel, didn't listen, didn't move quick enough. And now what's essentially they're doing, and if you look at the last week in totality, it's about pulling the rug to make sure that Europe start moving, you know, and take a leap. So that's what they're saying. The Americans in that administration, they basically see China as a pacing threat, and they know that they need to reorientate within the next 2 to 3 years to face that in a major, major way. So that's the kind of timeline I'm thinking that Europe has to step up. It's also, you know, a couple of years is the assessment of most of the European and US intelligence communities about when Putin, if he intended to go again, could go again in terms of his military force.
For Morning Ireland, a lot to take in. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On the Drama on One, Truth, Love or Promise, written and performed by Nuala McKeever. Three women meet at a creative writing class.
After the class, I'm sitting here in the cafe downstairs. I'm meeting my daughter in an hour, so I'm going to have a quiet cup of tea and look over my notes. After the shoes, Fiona gave us a warm-up exercise. We had to write something called an acrostic. It's, you know, where you write the letters of your name down the side of a page. Then you have to come up with a word starting with each of the letters to make a sentence. Some of them were brilliant. Your woman, Joanna?
Joanna. J-O-A-N-N-A. Joyfully onto another nice new adventure.
Your woman, Maureen, kept complaining that her name was too long, said she was going to use her nickname, Mo. You'll never guess what she came out with. Mo. M-O. Missing orgasms. Place fell apart. Then Fiona looks at me. I said, actually, do you mind if I don't read mine out loud? I don't think I did it properly. But your woman Maureen starts. Like, it's only a bit of crack, Brenda. Go on, just tell us. I said no, but she grabbed my notebook and she read it out loud. Brenda, be ready. Expect nothing. Disappointment avoided. Nobody clapped. I didn't even mean to write that. Expect nothing. Avoid disappointment. Do you know who that sounds like? My mother.
Oh, it is all our fate. And staying with the drama, darling, on Sunday with Miriam, Conleth Hill, who's playing King Lear at the Gate Theatre in Dublin.
They probably have to age you up, though.
Not as much as you would think, but thank you very much. No, not that much. He's, you know, sadly, I'm old.
Is it amazing that King Lear is still so relevant hundreds of years on? I mean, what is it about the play and I suppose about Shakespeare? It's extraordinary, actually.
I think it's him. I think he just has such a brilliant observation of the human condition and all its various prisms and just such accurate accounts of human emotion. And that doesn't change, I suppose. Everything else might change, but we still hate and love and get angry and et cetera, as we did then. And he noted it so well.
And as they chatted, Miriam picked up on this seemingly throwaway remark.
When you say you've been socially isolating since the 80s,
yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I not the 80s maybe, but supposedly Game of Thrones. You know, I'm not going out to pubs at night because I can deal with people during the day, but when somebody gets drunk and is sent over by their mates to kind of go, you're an actor, and then you have to go through your whole CV, which is just, you know, not
an amazing role. Varys, he lasted many, many, many years. I mean, they only killed you off in the very end, didn't they?
I know they've literally hired and fired me twice because the next series they did was Three Body, and I played a pope in that who got fried by the sun. So I don't know what it is about me, but they're like hiring and firing me.
What is it, do you think, about Game of Thrones that made it so huge? And did you love your time in it?
I loved the first five seasons, and then I've publicly stated that, you know, I didn't enjoy the arc of the character so much in the last two series. But I've also said that that's just a hazard of being in a multi-character piece. But yes, by and large, I loved it. It was life-changing financially. Yeah, I've no regrets about it at all. And the great thing was I don't look very much like my character.
No.
And so that would always be my aspiration is, you know, it's fine if the characters are famous.
Yeah.
But they can have that fame. I'm not interested, you know.
Now, if you were to see Conleth Hill now, a man with a fine head of hair. But for that role on Game of Thrones, oh, things were very different.
You had a shaved head, obviously, for first, but I'm looking at you now, which is appropriate for King Lear, and you've a great head of hair.
Thanks very much.
And a beard. So did you mind having to shave your head?
Only the first time. I remember crying the first time.
Really?
Well, I'd never had my head shaved in my life, and it was a bit like a baby's posterior after denappying, and I just remember Rory McCann, who played the Hound, coming along and saying, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "Oh, I've just sold my soul to HBO," and he said, "Expletive up and think of your pension." So after that, it was fine. I just shaved it every summer and it grew back, you know, in between.
Bringing us to Brendan Courtney in for Ray.
You have lovely hair, by the way, just
thank
to say.
You.
I have a natural skill. I can tell when someone's had their hair cut. I can actually tell. It's really weird because I was a hairdresser.
Okay, yeah.
My
mom
was a hairdresser,
go.
And so I washed hair and folded towels and swept up. The smell of perm lotion reminds me of Christmas. You know, I'm from that generation.
And turns out the whole family mad for the hair.
My sister had her beehive searched once in the airport with a knitting pin.
Yeah. Oh my God!
She used to wear her hair really up. She thought she was great.
Wow, always good for a bit of contraband. Now, to an interview yesterday that was, well, words like sorrow and anger spring to mind. Joining Oliver, Lancome singer Rady Pete and Dan Lambert, Chief Operations Officer at Bohemians Football Club and manager of Kneecap. They have a daughter together who's just turned 3. But when she was about 17 months, they noticed she wasn't reaching key milestones.
Hand gestures and words. I didn't realise she was meant to be saying words. I didn't realise she should be able to wave bye-bye, that kind of stuff. And yeah, for me, you know, it's quite a shock and realisation because, you know, that's the thing about autism is that you don't, I had a totally normal birth and then you think you have a totally normal child and you're envisioning, you know, what your future is going to look like, what their lives are going to look like. You know, I was planning what instrument she was going to play and all, you know.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you realise everything's going to look different and you have to kind of, this maybe is not everybody's experience, but for me, I had to kind of grieve for the child that I thought I had. You know, it's a very emotional thing. Like it's very difficult. And unfortunately in Ireland, it just gets more difficult from there.
But it was when they went looking for support and services for their daughter that the reality of what they were facing really hit home.
Nothing is going to be done at the appropriate time. Everybody in the system is telling you, like, listen, I know it shouldn't be like this, but this is the way it is. You know, like, and the people who work within this system are hardworking, diligent people who are way overburdened. Like, their caseloads must be absolutely crushing. It must be so demoralising to see children years too late. Like, they know from a professional standpoint how much is being missed when they see these children, you know. But honestly, as the parent, it's like the worst journey of discovery in the world. And I kept feeling like, at every point, if I could just get to the next stage, if I could just get her assessment of need done, if I could just, you know, and it is a battle. That's the thing they tell you. They even tell you in the HSE, you know, like the people who work in it, they're like, you have to be an advocate for your child. You're going to have to battle for everything. But you're told this while you're also trying to work, you're trying to do your job, you're trying to take care of a special needs child, you're trying to keep your life together, you know what I mean? Mm. And you're also trying to learn this vast amount of information about autism, you know, and about whatever particular issues the autism is causing your child, you know. So it's total overwhelm. And then also just disbelief, like I just couldn't believe the things I was being told. The wait lists I was being told, I couldn't believe, I was like, that can't be right. Mm. But the thing is that you keep thinking that, like, at the next step, the people will come to help and it'll become fair and something will happen. And then you get to the next step and you realise there's nothing there.
Their daughter is non-verbal, and given that early intervention is key, time is of the essence. But their frustration with the system was palpable.
As Reddy said earlier, we're at the start. It's, well, it seems like we're in the middle, but really at the start. And after this comes, I read articles only this week and some of them on RTE, on your own website, about people trying to access school places and not being able to. And one woman who tried to get onto 46 schools and has a child who's in the car every day saying, car, 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 because they want to go to school and can't with their siblings. So, like, I suppose what you're trying to do is find as much information as possible and take this opportunity that you contacted us to speak. But there's so many people out there who know more than we do. And really at every single turn now. So initially it's the assessment of need. Now it's the way for the CDNT team. Now it's going to be trying to find a preschool place. It's going to be trying to find a school place. So in every direction, the system is broken. And it's important to say, and I think we have probably covered it, but like the staff in the system,
yeah,
you know, deserve huge credit. Who would want to work in an environment like that? Because by the time when you get to speak to somebody, you're so kind of at your wit's end, or you need it so badly that you're kind of, you know, you maybe treat people a little bit.
They're like, probably expecting you to, because that's probably all the parents they're meeting.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Oliver read out a statement from the HSE, which acknowledged that waiting for an extended period of time was not acceptable, and that said that they were sorry to those families who have had a poor experience in trying to access services.
Yeah, like, I'm sorry isn't good enough. It just isn't good enough. Like, I'm sure they are sorry, but it's, you know, like, this is, for anyone actually living this, like, to hear that kind of statement, you're just like, well, that's great, but, like, when are you going to do that? How are you going to do that? And for, I have to say as well, at the end of the election, to hear all the politicians suddenly start talking about CDNT, children with disabilities, bandying it around like a little, you know, flag, like, oh, we'll do this for you. And all the parents who've been waiting on all that stuff for so many years, you know, suddenly hearing their life being talked about like that, and it was just used as a way of getting re-elected. It's exactly the same people who'd overseen this whole system completely collapse, and they'd done nothing about it. And then suddenly they're using it to get re-elected. Like, the HSE is, like, it's not good enough. It's not good enough.
And throughout the interview, they stressed that they were in exactly the same position as many thousands of other families in the country.
And you mentioned at the start, like, you know, our careers or whatever, but we were phoned by the Irish Times and were contacted by your show. The vast, vast, vast majority of people in our position aren't phoned by anybody. And they're in a much more difficult position, that they're not able to come on the radio
profile
and speak about it.
Yeah,
and really,
exactly,
we're coming in here really to speak to, not just for our daughter, but for the tens of thousands of kids are in the same position and families in the same position.
And Oliver asked them about the impact of all of this on their lives.
People would be amazed that you've kept your very public jobs going throughout all of this. And it must be such a different world,
yeah,
to come from red carpets and glitzy to your struggles at home.
Yeah, and like, we both have to, like, my job, I have to appear very highly functional, you know, like, I have to go on stage. And like, Lancome has cancelled a number of gigs in the last, and this is why. And
really?
It's not really, like, you know, it is partially to do with, you know, not being able to be away from my daughter for too long, but sometimes it's literally that I cannot, like, with my own mental health, I cannot get it together to get on stage. And like, and a lot of it is after, let's say, appointments where I would have found out that, oh, there is no services here, or no, there is another wait list. A lot of it was directly after realising how much the system was going to fail our daughter. You know, and just the devastation that brings. Like, so I had to, like, I couldn't actually, like, I think I've managed to do a lot of my job, but I couldn't at certain points. You know, I was nominated for an Ivor Novello.
Yes.
I didn't go because that morning I had an appointment for our daughter with a neurologist, and I had, at that point, I had learned that all of these appointments usually are devastating. And it was. And I'm glad I didn't book a flight, because I spent the day totally devastated. And I just didn't go.
And an award nomination, one of the most prestigious things.
It's one of the most prestigious things.
One of your dreams you would have had as a musician.
Yeah. And I just said, no, I'm going to be in bits, so I just won't go.
And this was how the interview finished up.
You have to get up every single day and speak to this child as though someday they will speak back. Mm. And that takes a lot of energy and strength to do that, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very tiring, because she doesn't speak back. And you just have to keep doing it every single day, you know? And, like, that's upsetting. And you also, like, are trying to enjoy your child as well because, you know, she's three, she'll only be three once. You're also conscious of the time passing and you're like, I don't want this to all be bad memories. I want to have enjoyed my child.
It's desperately sad. I really feel for you. There's a message that says, I wanted to let you know, tell that mother she's advocating for us all. I feel like that could be me speaking on your show. I'm in the very same position. Well done for highlighting this on the programme. I mean, it's very, very difficult place. But listen, you're two incredible people for what you've endured to come out and speak to all those parents that you've met. And I'm sorry it's so difficult.
But it's so difficult for all of those families. Like, this is just one child. This is just one, I'm just one mother talking, one father. Like, you know, there's so many people going through this. And that's why I'm just trying to, like, just let, because that's the thing, you might hear about it fleetingly on the radio and then you go back to your life. For these people, this is their lives every single day.
Rady Pete and Dan Lambert with Oliver yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. A modular home, a log cabin, a slightly superior shed. A variety of descriptions you might have heard this week in relation to the possible relaxation of planning rules for, how shall we put this, dwellings, nice and neutral, that could be put down at the back garden. All part of the government's efforts to tackle the housing crisis. So now, a 40 square metre dwelling could be detached from the main house. On Morning Ireland, Orla Hegarty, Assistant Professor at the School of Architecture in UCD, thought it might work, but she was also wary of what she would describe as beds in sheds.
Well, it's like lots of things, there's pros and cons. I think on the one hand, there would be places where it's quite suitable, where people have larger gardens. And obviously, in terms of families, maybe it would help to pay the mortgage if it's rented out, or there's a situation with carers or students. It could be a very good solution for some families, and they may have space for that. But I think, like everything, we need to be careful about deregulation, because the regulations are normally there for good reasons. So we need to be careful about the safety of people who are in these buildings, sanitation, and also the impact on neighbours. If it's a tight urban area and there's a lot of activity to and fro, it could be very disruptive to neighbours if something is now exempt from planning. And I think they've found that in the UK when they deregulated, the phenomenon of beds and sheds became a thing, where there was very, very low standard, overcrowded buildings put on properties. And then if you make it exempt, enforcement becomes very difficult. So if something is done, I think they will need to put the strong guidance around it, strong guidance about building regulations, safety, fire safety, sanitation, and also recognise that there are situations where sites will be just too tight for this to work.
Well, for more detail on what exactly is being proposed, Minister of State for Local Government and Planning, John Cummins, joined Clare.
Who, in your view, will look after regulation here to make sure that these things are habitable? Things like fire regulations and safety.
It's a matter for the local authorities in the context of ensuring that things are compliant with planning and building standards in the same way as if it was the case if this was attached to the main dwelling house.
I don't understand how, if it's exempt from planning, how will it work then? Will you as a homeowner have to say, look, we have decided that granny and granddad or the younger couple are going to live in this thing. Will you come out and inspect it? Will you have to do that under your plans?
Well, I would envisage, Claire, and these are all matters that are up for discussion, because obviously there's going to be a consultation with other departments in relation to wider issues around exempted development. I know my colleague, Minister Martin Hayden, is looking for exemptions in the area of slurry storage. Other departments will have their view in relation to that. So we'll do that over the next couple of weeks, and then this will go out on public consultation.
Because there's if there's no inspection, it's a free-for-all, right?
But currently, Claire, you can put a 40-metre extension onto the back of your house today without having to go through the planning process. As I said, I'm not proposing that there would be any difference with this. The only change would be that it would not have to be attached to the main dwelling house.
Okay.
I think that's common sense. It's a practical measure. I'm not for one second suggesting that this is a solution to the housing crisis, and it won't be suitable in all circumstances.
Okay.
But where it is, I think it will be a welcome move by the public.
So, Owen, how-
But later on Drive Time, Rory Hearn of the Social Democrats had questions around regulations, the potential for exploitation, and yes, just how these dwellings will be counted when it comes to the housing figures.
If the government said they're not going to be deemed housed, these won't be counted officially as part of the housing figures. And if they said these can't be rented out. Now, neither of those, I give you, have been clarified. But if the government said no to renting out and no to including these in the housing figures, then would you support it?
Well, I think we do have to, and say, like, I do think we have to look at our planning system and to see how it can facilitate homes, smaller homes like these in back gardens. But I don't think we should go down the road of exemptions from planning permission. We need to ensure that what is being built is of a standard that is livable. My real concern is that we're really saying to generation locked out, generation stuck at home, what you should be aiming for is a shed out the back rather than actually a home of your own. This is really, to a certain extent, getting the government off the hook from their failure to deliver, as we've seen today, real affordable housing on a scale that will provide people's homes. Okay. Because the question is, for example, is this suitable for families? And of course, the issue is in rural areas where you have more space, I think there's more potential for this. In back gardens, are we talking about, you know, families living, you know, two or three families on a site? That, you know, how is the, in terms of, you know, is there going to be issues of overcrowding? Is there going to be in a small, you know, 40 square metre unit, two parents, two kids? You know, what is the situation?
I suppose, Rory, is the problem not that that family that you're describing there, maybe grandparents, then the kids, the adult children, and then their children as well, are at the moment living together in one house because they've nowhere to go? They're living in the box room, they're sleeping on the couch, they're the uncounted homeless figures. Is this not better than that? It's not perfect, but is it not better than that?
Well, as I said, I do think we have to look at this. I'm not saying that this is, you know, completely wrong as a concept or an idea, but I think we need to be very, very careful about changing planning regulations and what we think we might be solving something, but actually we won't really. And there are people already.
From Drive Time. But for callers to Liveline, some despairing. Has it really come to this? But others getting out the circular saw to create some Scandi Hygge.
What do you think of the idea, Des? The little house in the back garden.
Yes, I think it's a wonderful idea and it should have been done years ago.
And do you have one?
I have. It's almost like a Scandinavian feel on the inside because you have an apex roof. You can heat them to about 23, 25 degrees in maybe 15 minutes. So it's almost like going on holidays in your garden.
It's a genius idea. It's brilliant. And about time the government started speaking a bit of sense. I have teenage children. They're already talking about emigrating. My garden, my everything. It's a small garden.
Yeah.
I absolutely adore it. I would give up every blade of grass in my garden if it meant my children stayed in Ireland and didn't emigrate.
My daughter's living with me. With three grandchildren.
Oh, okay.
So don't get angry very often, Joe.
Yeah.
But we had the last election and one of the major issues on it was housing. If you're building a pod in your back garden, for me it doesn't solve the solution. As I say, I think my daughter will probably be for at least the next 5, 6, maybe 10 years.
Again, like our house would probably be too big. And so we have some of the kids at home at the moment, one of them has gone to the States because he said it's far too expensive to buy a house over there.
Okay.
The other ones we're keeping here at the moment, and we want them to kind of stay to save up for a mortgage or a good deposit rather than going into rented accommodation. I only had this conversation with my wife the other day. If we built out something at the back,
okay,
I'd be quite happy to go into it because, you know, as you get older, it's much, much harder to maintain and keep a decent-sized house.
Yeah.
We were, got evicted last year from our house and we had to do something in the meantime. So I put a mobile up, which is 40 square metres. By size, and I also extended it by 30 square metres by myself, which is obviously 70 in total, but still.
Which is illegal, do you mind me saying that?
You know, which is absolutely, it's purely legal, I know that, but lack of options,
I understand.
I had to do something about it, I have a family. And so.
And do you worry about it being illegal?
Absolutely, I worry about it every day, but thank God that the people I live nearby are all kind of respected and we all kind of respect each other. We don't really put ourselves in bad places. So,
we built a log cabin about 5 years ago now at this stage. The cabin is absolutely perfect. It's a one-bedroom cabin between the two of us. My partner went back to college, so it was kind of the only option for us, really, if we wanted to stay in this country. Not even looking to buy a house. It's just not affordable for people in their 20s at the moment.
So you're saying to John Comas, bring it on.
Come here. I've been advocating it for so long.
Okay.
I've done so
well
many
done.
Articles on this. Like, they need to be brought in. They are a big solution.
From Liveline. Now, she was on to talk about dogs. She loves her dogs. But then Linda Martin threw this in.
Listen, you two, in future address me as Lady President.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, yes, you're running for president. Is that the case?
No, I'm saying nothing at all. That's all I'm saying.
Is that real? Are you really doing that?
Oh, you'll have to wait and see now.
Oh, she is. That's such a
Linda Martin not ruling herself out of president.
Oh, that'd be
now, can you,
on his
can you
at least the dogs will have loads of room. Wow.
Can you imagine all the dogs in the Irish?
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, my God. You've got the dog thing going for you. You've got Eurovision and you've got cross-border. You've got everything going for you, Linda Martin.
Yeah. Absolutely.
As an independent
woman, she has a phone to Europe.
Sorry, Jason. Important story going on here.
No.
As an independent or with a party now, would you be considering?
Oh, a party, I think. Yes, a party.
Yeah. Which one?
Which party?
I can't say that. I can't tell you.
How are you going to get president?
This sounds like talks. Has someone approached you from a party?
I was approached. Sounds bizarre, but you're...
You can ring people
strange.
For that now, Linda.
What?
There's people you can ring if you get approached.
Okay, that's extraordinary.
Can you imagine what
so
I could be doing?
She's been approached by a party. She's not telling us which one it is.
I don't know how she's going to get elected if she doesn't tell anybody yet.
But you're seriously considering this?
Yeah.
Let's just say I'm mulling it over.
Start your engines, people. Meanwhile, on Mooney Goes Wild, flagons of cider and bird sounds.
But at the end of Woody Woodpecker's call there, you can hear what sounds like the drumming sound. So let's have a listen to the drumming of a pileated woodpecker. Here it is. Just a wonderful sound, isn't it? You can see how they drew their inspiration for the opening sequence from nature, Niall.
It does. I mean, woodpeckers, the drumming, you can actually identify different species by the pattern of the drumming, how loud it is, how rhythmic it is, all of those kind of things. And the green woodpecker is one that doesn't drum all that much. It does a bit, but the pileated in North America drums a lot more than the green woodpecker does. And, of course, our great spotted woodpecker drums a lot too. For many woodpeckers, that's their equivalent of a song. It's sort of hammering out this percussion section. I think in the dawn chorus, they like the percussion section of the orchestra.
So the moral of the story is, if you're drinking cider, drink cider. And if you're listening to birds, listen to birds. But ne'er the twain shall meet.
And on arena, Bernard McMahon, the documentary maker behind Becoming Led Zeppelin, a group no stranger to mixing their drinks.
We've all heard about the excesses of the later Led Zeppelin, but here, when they're touring America, they're a young band trying to make their name, and there's no glamour, there's not much excess is being shown, and it's
absolutely
all leading.
Right. Robert and people talk about those things starting to circle, but yes, they're essentially four guys in a saloon car. You know what I mean? Driving from gig to gig. This is before, you know, the big, you know, jumbo jets and all that stuff. And really, that's one of the key messages that I got as a kid from, reading this story and then taking the screen is, you can't get to that place where you're impacting people that much in that first year if you're out of your mind. You just can't do it. And I remember when I read that book, I was thinking, the perception of this group is so much based on the mid-70s onwards. But what actually got them to that point was this unbelievably hard work and dedication. You know, and so I love untold stories, particularly stories if the reality of how something happened is very different from how it's been portrayed in the subsequent decades, you know? It's really about the kid... to get to that point in that first year, to overcome those obstacles, to get through, you have to be very focused. That's
right. You need cool air, baby, I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you back to school. Give you my love.
letting the lid out. And that feels weirdly appropriate for this next little frog spawn mosh pit with Clare ecologist Donna Mullen.
So what happens is the females go to the little patch of water, and then the males jump on top of them to fertilise the eggs as they're laying them. Now, the females are slippery. So the males have this little thing on their wrists called an uptual pad, and it's like Velcro, and it sticks them to the back of the female.
To the slippy back of the female?
Yeah, the slippy back. So yeah, so they have a thing, like a little suction cup thing, because other than that, they just would slide off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other males come along as well, and then there's wrestling goes on. Between they're all trying to jump on the female.
Okay, but if you have this male who's singing and all the females rush along, is there another male who'll say, oh, that fella has attracted all those females, so I'm going to try and muscle in?
Yes, exactly. And then there can be a bit like the Bridget Jones Diary kind of thing. The two males are fighting and wrestling. And the female in all of this, it's really why anyone putting in a pond for frogs, it should be shallow. The female can end up getting drowned under all this, all the males all fighting over. And then there's the males, actually the Irish Herpetological Association call them the pirate males. And these, but I think they should be the pacifist males. They're the ones that look and say, I'm not going to fight here. This isn't worth the hassle. I could end up getting killed. So they steal the frog spawn. So they take the frog spawn and they fertilize.
The passive male.
Yeah. So they call they're usually like frogs that are small.
Okay.
And kind of a bit wimpy, and they haven't a chance of getting on top of the female.
But sneaky.
So they take the frog spawn and then they fertilize it. Now, it'll mostly have been fertilized by the dominant male that's hanging on to the back of the female. But not all of it. And then so he has a chance of fertilising some of them.
Right. And the frog spawn, is that laid by the female in the same place where the party has happened?
Yes, exactly. And there'll be hundreds or thousands of frogs. You'll see them all, like it's just an enormous puddle of frogs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just absolutely amazing.
If you say so. And is it a frog or is it a toad?
You know, Amy Winehouse used to have that black eyeshadow round her eyes and going back to her. Frogs have that. So they have
a eyeliner.
Black patch, like eyeliner. And they have black bars on their legs as well.
And the toads are more like Pamela Anderson, no makeup.
You know, makeup. And they're also a little warty.
Okay.
So you're very lucky if you have toads.
The parties are underway. We're getting messages in from people. This person was walking in Devil's Glen in County Wicklow this morning and they saw about 30 frogs and the ponds were bubbling and hopping and you could hear the male singing.
Oh, fantastic.
It's happening.
It most certainly is. You know what they could use? A little bit of Enya. Her album Watermark, RTE Choice Music Prize Classic Irish Album for 2024. Breathing in, breathing out. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. Let me see.